the EU, the US, NATO and Ukraine.
It is clear that any deal behind our backs will not work. Any agreement will need also Ukraine and Europe being part of it.
Are more trade tariffs on the way from Washington?
If we're thinking about imbalanced trade as a measure of whether trade is fair or not, tariffs just don't address that issue.
And the fight heats up in Congress over foreign aid.
Republicans have defended the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue.
Today is Friday, February 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Multiple NATO allies expressed support Thursday for boosting defense spending while highlighting the need for Ukraine and other European nations to be a part of any negotiated end to Russia's war against Ukraine. Mark Rutte is the NATO Secretary General.
We all want peace in Ukraine, rather sooner than later. We all want Ukraine to be in the best possible position when those talks start, to make sure that they can be concluded successfully. And as also Pete Hegseth said yesterday, the new American Secretary of Defense, it is crucial that whatever comes out of those talks, it is durable.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said on Thursday that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is an urgent, real threat to the continent and should be a wake-up call when it comes to defense spending. This follows Hegseth's remarks on Wednesday when he told the alliance that European countries would need to pay more and that the U.S. would not continue to pay so much for Europe's security. It also follows President Donald Trump's separate phone calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. This raised concerns that Trump could possibly make a deal with Putin without Ukrainian input or approval. Kaya Kallas is the EU foreign policy chief.
Any quick fix is a dirty deal. It is clear that any deal behind our backs will not work. Any agreement will need also Ukraine and Europe being part of it. And this is clear that appeasement also always fails.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are scheduled to meet with Zelensky on Friday. All this as hundreds of world leaders and delegates are set to attend the Munich Security Conference this weekend, with conflicts in Ukraine, the Middle East, and simmering tensions in the Indo-Pacific on the agenda. As Henry Ridgewell reports, all eyes are on the new delegation from the United States.
Ukraine's war against Russia's full-scale invasion is about to enter its fourth year. The conflict will top the agenda as hundreds of world leaders and delegates attend the Munich Security Conference starting Friday. It's the first major global summit for the new Trump administration in Washington. Christoph Heusgen is the conference chairman.
We are very happy that we will have a strong representation of both the administration of the new American government there, as well as representation from Congress.
The U.S. delegation includes Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Vance is scheduled to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky said this week he shared a common vision with the Trump administration.
Of course, there may be different opinions, but a common vision of the main things, of how to stop Putin and how to give guarantees of security to Ukraine and Ukrainians.
Washington wants a quick end to the war, but it's not clear how that might happen. In a Fox News interview Tuesday, President Trump said Ukraine, quote, may be Russian someday, or they may not be Russian someday. Allies hope to maintain Trump's support for European and Ukrainian security, says analyst Charles Grant of the Center for European Reform.
He hasn't threatened to pull out of NATO, hasn't said he's going to cut off all aid for Ukraine. One of the issues that will come up in Munich is to what extent the Europeans should help to keep the peace if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine.
Russia has not been invited to this year's Munich conference, neither has Iran. China is sending a large delegation, with Asia-Pacific security also high on the agenda. This week, the US Navy sailed two warships through the Taiwan Strait, prompting an angry response from Beijing. China has ramped up military activity around Taiwan in recent months. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province. Taipei considers the island a sovereign state. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is due to hold a trilateral meeting with allies Japan and South Korea in Munich. Conflict in the Middle East will also top the agenda. Trump's repeated suggestion that Palestinians should leave Gaza and the United States take control of the territory has won support from Israel, but prompted strong criticism from other allies, notes Grant.
It's very disruptive and creates a lot of ill feeling between European and many other governments and the US.
Conflicts in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo will also be discussed. Climate change, energy security, and artificial intelligence will also be hot topics across the three-day conference. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
On Thursday in the White House, President Trump announced reciprocal tariffs on all imports into the country. For a deeper dive into what this means, I spoke with Doug Irwin, a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a professor of economics at Dartmouth College.
Well, what he said he was going to do is, if other countries tax our goods, we're going to tax theirs at the same rate. So we're going to have sort of equal taxes on particular items. Now, he actually didn't impose these taxes today. He just ordered an investigation about how such a system might work.
Well, let's talk about that. How might such a system work? How would this happen?
Well, it would be very complicated because what the U.S. has now under the World Trade Organization is a set of common duties across all countries. And these have been set in previous trade negotiations. Sometimes they're set at zero when we have a free trade agreement, such as USMCA with Canada and Mexico, or with Chile or Colombia or some other free trade partners. But otherwise, if you're a member of the WTO, you get a certain tariff rate assessed on your goods when you export to the U.S. But what this would do is completely upend that, and the tariff rates would be different for different countries, depending on what those countries charge the U.S. for those same goods.
Now, the president said he wants to do this so that more companies would start manufacturing their goods in the United States instead of abroad. Historically, have tariffs had that effect?
Sometimes tariffs can divert investment from other countries to the U.S. in sectors that are competing against imports. But what happens is if you constrain imports and reduce imports, you also, through various mechanisms, through the exchange rate, for example, affect U.S. exports. And so you won't change overall investment necessarily, you're going to be diverting investment from certain industries that are facing foreign competition away from investment in industries that export or depend on intermediate inputs that are imported from abroad.
So let's take a couple quick examples. Trump said this would be good for agriculture. If I were a farmer someplace, would I be happy about today's news?
It really depends on whether you're a big exporter or facing foreign competition. And what's sort of ironic is there's an assumption built into the president's statement and understanding of this that other countries have much higher tariffs than the U.S. does. So he says other countries are taking advantage of the U.S. and are low tariffs. But in some instances, other countries have lower tariffs than the U.S. does. And if you were to take this policy at its face value, the U.S. would have to reduce its tariffs on some agricultural commodities. So, for example, when countries are big exporters of, say, sugar or dairy products, usually they don't need very high tariffs because the industry has such a crushing advantage in world markets. And against those countries, the U.S. might have to reduce its tariffs because the U.S. actually is an importer of dairy and sugar to protect domestic industries.
Interesting. What about large manufactured goods, say, cars and trucks that take lots of different parts from all over the world?
Yeah, it would certainly complicate the supply chains that have been built up because we'd be imposing tariffs presumably on those parts. But here again, it's sort of a mixed idea. So one complaint that the president has had is that Europe charges a 10% tariff on cars and the U.S. charges a 2.5% tariff on cars. And he says this is causing this imbalance in trade. But the U.S. also charges a 25% tariff on light trucks, whereas Europe's tariff on light trucks is only 10%. So if you were to go to this policy of reciprocity, the tariff on cars would go up in the U.S. from 2.5 to 10%, but the tariff on light trucks would fall from 25% to 10%. And it's not clear that that's the domestic auto industry would want that, or that members of Congress would be happy with that situation.
I think at the heart of Trump's decision is that he believes the U.S. is being treated unfairly in the world. Is it?
I don't believe so in a particular way. Yes, there are foreign policies that discriminate against U.S. firms, but on average, tariffs among European countries compared to the U.S. are roughly similar. Obviously, there's variation across products. Many developing countries have much higher tariffs, but those don't necessarily lead to trade imbalances per se. If we're thinking about imbalanced trade as a measure of whether trade is fair or not, tariffs just don't address that issue. Capital flows, exchange rates, and other factors are much more important than tariffs in determining what the bilateral trade flows look like.
Doug Irwin is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Mr. Irwin, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
You're most welcome.
And in the Middle East, amid tension that the ceasefire deal might fall apart and following further military buildup by Israel, Hamas is signaling that it will abide by the agreement. Zachary Goldman of Reuters has that story.
An Israeli hostage freed from Hamas captivity was released from hospital on Thursday and greeted by a cheering crowd as he returned home. Ohad bin Ami was returned to Israel last Saturday as part of a Gaza ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group aimed at ending 15 months of war.
This is a very emotional day and happy because Ohad is back home. But we need not to forget there are so many people still not home, and we need to support them, to do everything we can do to support our government to take this next step to fulfill the deal.
That deal appeared near to unraveling this week amid accusations of violations on both sides. Hamas on Thursday said it did not want the agreement to collapse, but it said it rejected what it called the, quote, language of threats and intimidation from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Donald Trump. The Israeli and American warnings came after Hamas accused Israel of holding up an expected influx of aid deliveries and said it would not hand over three more hostages on Saturday until the issue was resolved. That prompted Netanyahu and Trump to warn the ceasefire should be canceled if the hostages were not freed. In a statement, Hamas said it, quote, reaffirms its commitment to implementing the agreement as signed, including the exchange of prisoners according to the specified timeline. The war in Gaza erupted after a Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, that killed at least 1,200 people, according to Israeli tallies, and saw more than 250 taken as hostages. That triggered a relentless Israeli response that has laid waste to the coastal enclave and killed more than 48,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health officials. Under the current ceasefire, Hamas has so far released 16 Israeli hostages out of 33 captives to be exchanged for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel in the first stage of a multi-phase deal. Continuing talks in Cairo have focused on issues such as Israel's allowing the entry of mobile homes, tents, medical supplies, and fuel. Hamas said heavy machinery was needed for the removal of rubble. International aid officials confirmed that aid was coming in despite considerable logistical problems, though they cautioned that far more was needed. The threat to cancel the 42-day ceasefire that formed the basis of the agreement has drawn thousands of Israeli protesters onto the streets this week, calling on the government to stick with the deal in order to bring the remaining hostages home.
That's Reuters' Zachary Goldman reporting for us. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. A federal judge on Thursday blocked U.S. health agencies from enforcing President Donald Trump's order ending all federal funding or support for health care that aids gender transitions for people younger than 19. The lawsuit alleged that Trump's order discriminates against transgender people and goes beyond his authority as president. An American aircraft carrier, the USS Harry S. Truman, was involved in a collision at sea with a merchant vessel near Port Said, Egypt, the Navy said on Thursday. The collision occurred late Wednesday while both ships were moving. There were no injuries aboard the carrier and there was no damage to the ship's propulsion system. None of the crew on the merchant ship were injured either, according to a defense official. A driver drove a car into a labor union demonstration in central Munich on Thursday, injuring 30 people, including children. Officials said it was believed to be a deliberate attack. The suspect, an Afghan asylum seeker, was arrested. The incident follows a series of attacks involving immigrants in recent months that have pushed migration to the forefront of the campaign for Germany's February 23rd election. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at U.S. domestic politics, Democratic lawmakers said on Wednesday that the Trump administration's freeze on U.S. foreign assistance, particularly the freezing of U.S. aid payments, might permanently damage America's security and standing abroad. Republicans counter that the review of the U.S. Agency for International Development Programs is necessary to combat waste and fraud. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Uncertainty around the world as the fate of U.S. foreign assistance programs is under review. Chris Coons is a Democratic senator.
We are losing decades of experience and insight, deep relationships, effective interventions in some of the most dangerous and distant places on Earth, and we are betraying partners who have risked their place in their communities and countries by publicly aligning with us.
Experts told lawmakers during a panel discussion Wednesday that foreign aid represents less than 1% of the total U.S. budget and pushed back against claims of wasteful spending. Jeremy Conendike is the president of Refugees International and a former USAID official.
USAID has been the target of a concerted campaign of disinformation led by Elon Musk and amplified by the President of the United States. They have deployed a fire hose of falsehoods to slander an agency whose mission is fundamental to advancing America's interests in the world.
Republicans have defended the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
USAID is an agency that let us all down. I've been advocating for soft power for my entire time up here. And what I have seen makes me sick to my stomach.
The Trump administration has granted waivers allowing some aid programs to resume, although Democratic senators questioned on Wednesday if this was happening on the ground. In the Oval Office Tuesday, Musk said his work is following a clear process.
It's not just us just going in and doing things willy-nilly. It's in partnership with the agency heads, and I check frequently with the president to make sure that this is what the president wants to have happen.
Development assistance supports more than 100,000 jobs in the United States. One of the thousands of USAID employees suddenly without work said the consequences of even a temporary stop to some U.S. assistance will be long-ranging.
We work not by forcing people to have respect for America or by telling people to have certain values, but by supporting them in the ways that they feel that they need.
U.S. contractors and non-governmental organizations are suing the Trump administration over the freezing of USAID funds, saying it is an unconstitutional use of presidential power. Republicans say Trump is simply exerting his authority. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
One place where those blocked American aid payments is being felt is in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. That follows another flare-up of violence between the M23 rebels and the Congolese military. Fiona Jones of Reuters reports.
Agnes Mushengezi has turned her hairstyling skills into a lifeline. Having fled her hometown in Congo's war-torn east, she's braiding hair in her shelter to earn enough for food and other essentials.
I couldn't bear what was happening there. There were too many bombs, too many heavy weapons. I didn't have the strength or ability to endure it.
Despite the kindness of her hosts taking her in, life remains a struggle.
I ask the authorities and those who are responsible to do everything possible to end the war in our territory, because there are people still there who are suffering, and even we who are here are struggling. We have nothing to do, nothing to eat. Our activities have stopped. That's why we want the war to stop, to end.
Fighting between the Congolese army and Rwandan-backed M23 rebels in the east has killed thousands since early 2022. And Mushungazi is one of over a million people displaced by the conflict. Despite mediation efforts, the Tutsi-led rebels have been inching south since they seized eastern Congo's largest city of Goma at the end of last month.
So we are fearing a humanitarian catastrophe.
And South Kivu's governor, Jean-Jacques Purusi-Siddiqui, said the rebels' recent advancement into his province threatens to trigger a humanitarian crisis, with the under-resourced area already housing thousands of displaced people, many who fled more than once. This dramatic escalation of a decade-old insurgency in East Congo has stoked fears of a broader regional war. Amidst this, the country is hugely impacted by US President Donald Trump's foreign aid suspension, according to Congo's UN coordinator, Bruno Lemarquis.
Out of the $1.3 billion in humanitarian aid, $910 million came from the US, meaning we are 70% dependent on it. This makes Congo the most aid-dependent country in the world, and replacing that funding will be extremely difficult.
The rebels declared a ceasefire for humanitarian reasons at the start of February, but it rapidly crumbled. Congo's government said its troops had been attacked several times in different areas since a summit last week of Eastern and South African blocs aimed at defusing the crisis.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting. And finally today, back to Ukraine. Police and volunteers are moving quickly to evacuate people from frontline areas as the Russian army advances. In the Donetsk region, the nearest transit evacuation center is in Pavlorod. Lysia Baklets reports on the support being given to evacuees who've got nothing left.
It's afternoon in Pavlohrad in eastern Ukraine. Buses are arriving at the transit evacuation center. The center is the first relatively calm stop for people living frontline areas, mainly in the Donetsk region. The majority are elderly people with limited mobility. Svetlana came from Kramatorsk. VOA agreed to withhold last names for security reasons.
I hope to come back. They said the war will end in May. But now I'm sick and there's no one to help. All 90 apartments in my building are empty. Everybody's out.
About 10 charitable organizations work in the transit center.
We provide humanitarian, legal, psychological help, assistance with logistics, with resettlement. So this is a comprehensive approach.
Bogdan Zagorulko works for the East SOS Charitable Foundation. He says the group has evacuated 88,000 people since the start of the full-scale invasion.
In Pavlorad, the transit center has been operating since August 2024. Initially, we worked in Pokrovsk, but after the situation there worsened, we moved to Pavlorad.
After registering the evacuees, volunteers review documents and whether they have a place to stay before determining what kind of aid is needed. Meanwhile, psychologists work nearby. Yulia Akrad is a psychologist for the East SOS Charitable Foundation.
People are very often confused. They can cry, scream, and get angry. So I talk to them, calm them down, satisfy their basic needs, drink water, wash their hands. Sometimes people didn't even have that.
Some stay in the center for a few days while volunteers find a place for them to stay and look for relatives. The center says 10 to 15% have nowhere to go, so a state resettlement program steps in to help. An evacuation train runs from Pavlohrad every day. Again, Bogdan Zagorulko with the East SOS Charitable Foundation.
Наш фонд також займається розміщенням людей.
Our foundation also settles the people with limited mobility who need inpatient care. Unfortunately, the situation in Ukraine is critical now. The funding for geriatric institutions is being greatly reduced.
Zagorulko says last summer sometimes about 100 people went through the center every day. Now the numbers have decreased, but volunteers are ready for a possible new wave. Meanwhile, in the late evening, a new bus comes from Pokrovsk. Lilia and her three-week-old son arrive. Volunteers say the boy is one of the youngest they have ever seen here. Lysia Bakalets, VOA News, Pavlohrad, Ukraine.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Carrick.